One teacher's take on how the pandemic has driven us apart and what it will take to bring us together.
I think over the last couple of years, there's been a really crystallizing, a hardness, a sort of cruelty where we are detached from each other's humanity. We're remote from each other's humanity. And this book, obviously folks hopefully will get that the word remote doesn't just refer to online teaching, but the remoteness between each other. And so the goal of the book is to, yes, explore my pandemic experience as a cancer patient and a teacher and a father and all that, but also to help us think more about the ways in this particular moment that we can really strive to bridge those gaps that keep us remote.
That's Adam Bessie. Later in the show, we talk with him about his graphic memoir, Going Remote, A Teacher's Journey. It's illustrated by Peter Glanting. But first, we talk with historian Martha Hodes about her memoir, My Hijacking, A Personal History of Forgetting and Remembering. In 1970, she survived 6 days as a hostage on a hijacked plane when she was 12 years old. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. In-depth conversation with writers of all genres, on the air since 2004. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station and at writersvoice.net. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. On September 6, 1970, 12-year-old Martha Hodes and her 13-year-old sister were flying unaccompanied back to New York City from Israel when their plane was hijacked by members of the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine and forced to land in the Jordan Desert. Too young to understand the sheer gravity of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, Martha Hodes coped by suppressing her fear and anxiety. Nearly a half century later, her memories of those 6 days and nights as a hostage are hazy and scattered. Was it the passage of so much time? Or had trauma made her repress such an intense life and death experience? A professional historian, Hodes wanted to find out. So she used her training as an historian to interrogate the history of that hijacking. My Hijacking explores contemporaneous accounts, personal and collective memory, and the political context surrounding these events to create a nuanced and riveting narrative about the lingering impact of trauma. Martha Hodes is professor of history at New York University. She won the Lincoln Prize in 2016 for her book, Mourning Lincoln. Martha Hodes, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be here.
Your book, My Hijacking, well, I have to say the subtitle really asks my first question for you, A Personal History of Forgetting and Remembering. You know, in September of 1970, just to let our audience know, when you were 12 years old and your sister was 14, your plane was hijacked while you were coming back to New York City from some time in Israel after a visit with your mother. She had remarried at that time. This is a book about remembering that traumatic event, but also a book about forgetting. So talk about that interplay between those two concepts for you.
So this book is about my sister and I. I was 12, she was actually 13, and we were hijacked by a group called the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine and spent a week inside a plane in the Jordan Desert. And so as a historian, as a professional historian, for the first time writing about my own life, so a historian as memoirist, I think of the book as writing about my family as part of a world historical event when I was 12 years old. So much of the book is about thinking about that 12-year-old protagonist, both as myself, but also as a historical actor in the past. So I think of it, personal history, that phrase, personal experiences in historical context, bringing my skills as a historian to the process of memoir. So what that meant was researching the things I remembered, but also researching everything that I'd forgotten. And the challenge of writing about childhood memories and emotions is at the center of the book. One of the things about the book is, in many ways, it's about trauma and lost memory. And I would say I'm using the word trauma colloquially rather than clinically correctly. But what I mean by that is many readers, many of us have experienced traumatic incidents as children, and many of us don't remember those incidents. And so it doesn't have to be something as dramatic as being on a hijacked plane and being held hostage. But in many ways, it's about things that happened to us as children that we don't understand the significance of at the time, and that the grownups around us don't want to talk about. And so part of my project was exactly that. My family didn't talk about the hijacking after we came home, after we were released. And I should let readers know that nobody was harmed and nobody died in this hijacking. And so it was my journey, both researching as a historian, but also trying to let the emotions of that time, which I had so deeply buried, surface. I do want to say that I'm not talking about recovered memory, which is a debunked psychological phenomenon, but rather researching everything that happened and seeing if I could reach the emotions that I had buried very deeply as a child and all the way into my adulthood.
You know, it's so interesting that you say you're using the word trauma colloquially, not clinically. Nobody died. That's true. But you did spend 5 or was it 6 days in the desert on a plane that was wired with explosives, because that's almost one of the first things that the commandos did after they took control of the plane. It almost sounds as if you're, if I may be forgiven for saying this, that you're toning down what must have been actual terror. I know that in the book, you have a hard time reaching a memory of that terror, but you do yes. talk about how other people, including your sister, say that you were terrified.
Yes, that's exactly right. I certainly toned down that terror from the moment, well, on the plane. And I can say a little bit more about that because I kept a diary on the plane that I wrote in every day. So on the plane, certainly when I got home, and certainly all the decades afterwards. In the book, you're correct that I wanted to try to reach some of that fear. You know, historians love sources that are closest to the events we're writing about in time and place. And so my diary, at first I thought, would be this wonderful scaffolding that would be my trusted source in writing the book. What I rapidly found was that I had omitted from my diary fear and other emotions. So while I wrote every day, my entries were fairly cheerful. And the other piece of evidence from the time and place was that my sister, who was older and quite a little bit older, but quite a bit more honest with herself, she remembered that I had been very fearful, which is not something I had remembered. And not only did she remember that, but she and I gave an interview within days of coming home. And in that interview, I listened to the tape of that interview. She said, "You were afraid." And I said, "No, I wasn't." And she said, "Yes, you were." So that, as a historian, that piece of evidence very close to the event was very meaningful to me as a grown-up professional scholar writing this book. And there were also other sources that documented fear. So, for example, I came across a report by a doctor from the International Red Cross. The International Red Cross sent representatives to the desert, and they were permitted to board the plane and help with the health conditions, which became quite horrendous. And in this doctor's report, he talked about the hostages being very, very afraid. And so I had all of this evidence that said I was afraid. And part of the book was trying to reach that. And I have to say, I mean, in some ways, I'd like to leave this as a gift to the reader. What happened in writing the book was I never quite got there, but I was able to uncover some other emotions related to my family history.
And why did you, after all these years, want to reconstruct this? What about your life changed?
Exactly. So it was almost 50 years when I started researching the book. it certainly felt unresolved. As I said, no one in my family ever really talked about it. So the first thing that happened, 9/11 came in 2001. And with 9/11 came a certain intrusion of memories for both my sister and for me. I do want to be very clear for our listeners that there is not a straight line from the 1970 hijackings to 9/11. Just to say briefly, our hijackers were Marxist Leninists. The founder of the Popular Front was a Christian. So they were not Muslim jihadists. So very, very different. Nonetheless, learning of 9/11 and experiencing 9/11 as a New Yorker did bring back some memories. But it still took me 15 more years to begin to write this book. And I had such an interesting experience that I'd love to share with our listeners. I had finished my last book. I'm a 19th century historian. I study the Civil War and the U.S. in the 19th century. I'd finished a book about Lincoln's assassination, and I was in my agent's office talking with her about, you know, what do you think you'll write next? And I had started to do some research about the hijacking just for myself. I hadn't thought about writing about it, but it was something that I was feeling, you know, as I said, unresolved. And so I had started to read about it and find some archives. And as I was talking to my agent, her dog, her sweet little dog, was snoozing at her feet. And the dog got up, came over to my chair, and put his front paws on my knees and looked up into my face. And I said to my agent, "What's going on?" And she said, "Oh, Farley can tell when someone is in distress." Well, I didn't even know I was in distress. And that was such an amazing clue for me that this dog could sense this emotion I was having that I couldn't even tell. And so after that conversation, my agent, you know, she thought it would be a wonderful thing to write about. And I thought about it and continued to do research. And organically, it began to happen that I began to research and write this book.
And I'm so glad you did write this book. It was absolutely spellbinding to read. And also that you are a historian, I think, adds so much, because it's not just a memoir, although the memoir is key to the story and woven through every page of the book. But you also give a lot of context. You know, one of the most interesting things for me, and you kind of hinted about that just now, is that you had a very nuanced, even as a child, a nuanced relationship to your captors, to the hijackers. You had some sympathy for them. You talk a lot in the book about the context within which that they did what they did, and they also, you know, tried to explain themselves to their captives. So give us the historical context, but also your own relationship to them.
One of the things I discovered in writing the book, and I actually have to say I didn't know this as a 12-year-old on the plane, was that my sister and I were quite different from most, I would say, of the other American Jews on the plane. It was 1970, so it was 3 years after the 1967 war. And many American Jews, you know, post-1967, many American Jews were very supportive of Israel and the victory of the 1967 war. And many American Jews flocked to Israel to visit the newly occupied territories. There were people on the plane who had gone to Israel to have, say, a bar mitzvah, you know, at the Wailing Wall. My sister and I came from a very secular Jewish family. My mother was in Israel to help start the modern dance company, the Bet Sheva Dance Company. She had no interest in Zionism or Israel. She never took us to those holy sites. So we were different. What that meant was that my sister and I never went to Hebrew school. So we did not arrive in the hijacked plane with a narrative about Middle Eastern history. And for that reason, I think we were quite interested in the stories that our captors told. Now, part of what our captors wanted to do was bring attention to their cause. The Popular Front had been founded just after the 67 war, and they were a minority revolutionary militant group, part of the umbrella Palestine Liberation Organization, the PLO. As I said before, they were Marxist-Leninists. They believed in and were fighting for a democratic, pluralistic, secular state for Jews, Muslims, and Christians. They also believed in what was called at the time women's liberation and modernization. They were against Zionism, defined as the settling of a Palestinian homeland as a nation state for Jews. They were against imperialism, and they were also against conservative Arab governments. The leadership of the PFLP came from the educated middle and upper classes, doctors, lawyers, intellectuals. They recruited membership from refugee camps. And the point of the hijackings was to call attention to their cause. And by the way, other members of the PLO, the Palestine Liberation Organization, did not agree with the tactic of hijacking. But what I found as I was researching, and I spoke to my sister and thought about my own experience, some hostages on the plane were Holocaust survivors. They had been part of the Holocaust when they were children. And we felt terribly sorry for those people who really were struggling with a lot of what went on. Although, as I came to see, the Palestinian insurgents, you know, they were not the people responsible for the Holocaust. The Holocaust was a Christian and European endeavor. And that's one of the reasons that Palestinians felt it was unfair that they should have to give up their homeland at the end of the Holocaust. Nonetheless, we were children and we felt sorry for people who seemed terribly distressed. We also felt sorry for our captors and the stories they told us, because as children, many of them had been exiled from their homes. And, you know, I found the most interesting letter when I was researching some family papers that I had gone through. That summer, my mother and stepfather, who was Israeli, had taken us to a village called Ein Hod, a beautiful, beautiful little village that was settled by Israeli artists. And of course, my mother and stepfather took us there because they knew dancers and artists. And I found a letter my sister had written home to our father. And in it, she described the village of Ein Hod this way. She wrote something like, "Painters, sculptors, and printers live there in quaint little Arab-style houses surrounded by beautiful mountain views and flowers." And I remember this, and I remember how beautiful we thought the houses were. Well, what we didn't know was that the Palestinian inhabitants of Ein Hod had been exiled to refugee camps and then the village resettled by these Israeli artists. So when we wrote the phrase "quaint little Arab-style houses," we didn't know what we were describing. We didn't know that history. And so that's much of putting all of that together as a historian. I mean, obviously, I knew much of the history of Israel-Palestine by the time I wrote the book, but that specific example was very important to me.
Yes, it was really striking to read. It's almost the kind of, well, not in your case, you were children, but the willful blindness, you know, of colonialists who think they're coming to empty lands somehow.
Yes, that's right. That's right.
Yeah, and I think this is one of the things that I really loved about your book, Martha Hodes, about my hijacking, is that you interrogate everything with an open mind, and there is a deep compassion that underlies it. For example, you liked some of the commandos. A few of them were people that you really liked. Ahala Josephs, I believe, was one of them, Hala Joseph, and she played a very protective role at one point. Tell us about her and how she protected the girls and women.
Yes, absolutely. So I should say the thing about our captors, the commandos, is they were nice to the children on the plane. And I know that because I have not just my own memories, but I have footage, news footage in which, you know, reporters came out to the desert and in one case, you know, talked to this little boy who I then made contact with. He's a little younger than I am. And the reporter said, you know, what do you think of the Palestinians? This little 8-year-old boy said, you know, they're nice. They're pretty nice to us. So they were nice to the children. I should be clear, they were not always nice to the adults. A number of the adults suffered very intense interrogation, which I wasn't aware of at the time, up in the front of the plane. So people did have varied experiences, but as a child, and as the children among the hostages, there was, I remember this one commando who, you know, they let us out of the plane a number of times for exercise and air. And the first time we were let out of the plane, we all saw water on the horizon, which was actually a mirage because we were in the middle of the desert. And one of the commandos explained to the children the scientific workings of a mirage. And I remember him pointing to the horizon and telling us what was happening. And you know, they gave piggyback rides to the kids. They jumped rope with us. And then the person you're talking about, Hala Joseph, you know, very interesting, because part of the Popular Front's credo was, as I said, women's liberation, what we would call feminism today. And Hala Joseph was the commando in charge of our plane, a woman. And at one point, you know, people were moved from the plane at various points and brought to other areas, and we didn't know where they were. And by the last day, all of the men were removed from the plane. And that was frightening to some of the women because, you know, in a way we were in a wartime situation, and wartime is historically a dangerous time for women surrounded by soldiers. There's certainly a history of assault and rape. And some of the women hostages were worried. And there was a commando who was, you could say, kindly put it, you could say was flirting with some of the women. And Hala Joseph and the other, there were three women on our plane, three women commandos on our plane. They made sure, they went up to that man and said, you leave that woman alone or we'll shoot you. We'll shoot you like dogs, was actually the phrase she used. I didn't remember that phrase, but my sister remembered it. And I also found it in a news article. So she was very protective of the women and children, and she clearly commanded a certain amount of power, because that was the end of that kind of behavior by any of the male commandos.
And then, of course, there is the whole other issue about the danger, the actual danger that you were in. The captain came out early on, right after the plane was hijacked, to say that the hijackers had promised that, quote, no bodily harm would come to the hostages. But, you know, as I said in the beginning of our conversation, the commandos wired the planes with explosives right away. So how did you process that at the time, because you saw them wiring it with dynamite? And then later on, as you did this research and wrote this book, what was your thinking around the kind of danger you were in?
Thank you. That's a great question. So the first thing I should say is that I remembered the plane being wired with dynamite. So that was a memory that stuck in my mind, which I never wrote down in my diary. I had a number of memories of frightening events. One was the co-pilot coming out of the cockpit while we were up in the air and the hijacking was in progress. And he came out of the cockpit with somebody holding a gun to his neck. The commandos wiring the planes with dynamite the night we landed was an image I couldn't get out of my head ever, no matter how much I would have liked to erase it. And another was one of the women commandos, one of the three women commandos on our plane, was not a nice person. Everybody I spoke to remembered her as quite cruel. And at one point, she pointed her gun at me and told me to get back to my seat. So those were memories I couldn't erase, but that I never recorded because clearly I didn't want to remember them. Looking back, what I realized by reading the news coverage, by reading the literature of my captors, by reading interviews with other hostages in newspapers when they returned home, the commandos, our captors, told us the hostages one thing, but had to tell the world something else. So they told us, you know, everybody I spoke to remembered the announcement that came over the loudspeaker, which said, we are going to take you to a friendly country with friendly people. And of course, as historians, when, you know, 20 people say the same thing, it's considered very reliable evidence. Everybody remembered that phrase, friendly country, friendly people. We were told it's, quote, only a hijack. We were told that there would be no bodily harm. On the other hand, in order to make it a successful hostage-taking mission, our captors had to tell the world something else, namely that they were going to destroy the planes and all the hostages if their demands were not met. And their demands were the freeing of various Palestinian prisoners in various European jails, and especially in prison in Israel. So they had to tell us and the world different things. But it's also important to note that part of a hostage-taking mission involves keeping your captives off balance. So we also saw the dynamite, and our captors occasionally would mention the deadlines and would mention the threats and would say things like, if your government doesn't act soon, we are going to blow up this plane. So it was a complicated, frightening, nuanced situation where you could cling to one side or worry about the other. Now, the Popular Front's internal policy was not to harm anyone, and they didn't. But there were also other ways I came to learn during my research that we could have been harmed. So, for example, there were weapons all over the plane. You know, there were machine guns. All of the commandos carried machine guns. You know, who knows what would have happened if a passenger had grabbed one of those guns or if somebody had had a meltdown. There was also the possibility of an attack from the outside. So there were other ways that we could have been harmed. And, you know, as I said to your listeners earlier, I'm a historian of the 19th century and the Civil War era. And one of the things that scholars of the Civil War know is that the Civil War victory and defeat was not a foregone conclusion that the Union would win and the Confederacy would lose. It was very much based on what we call contingency on the battlefield, unpredictability, don't know what's going to happen in any given situation. And so that applies as well to the situation that we were in. It was very contingent on all kinds of factors that couldn't be predicted.
Yes, and I think that is the terrifying thing. When I read that in the book, I thought you guys were incredibly lucky when it came down to it.
Right, right.
When you embarked on this project, you wanted to know how the hijacking had affected your life. What have you discovered about that?
That's such a great question because, of course, for decades and decades, I dismissed the significance of the hijacking in my life. And one of my pieces of evidence for that was, you know, I went back to I was entering seventh grade in September 1970, and I was a couple of weeks late for school. And some of my friends I'm still in touch with, but I also got in touch with some of my seventh grade friends who I hadn't spoken with in many, many years. And I asked them what they remembered. And uniformly, they recalled that when I came back to school, I didn't want to talk about it, and that I was quite dismissive of it. And I also spoke with friends of mine from later years in my life, from high school and college and after college. And that dismissiveness was a theme that ran through people's memories of how I talked about the hijacking and how little I talked about it. And one of my seventh grade friends, she put it this way to me. She said, clearly, no harm done, no lasting effect. That was her overall sense of what it meant to me. So, of course, writing this book, I had to ask the question, why did I remember so little? And what could remembering tell me? And what would have happened if I'd allowed myself to remember? And so the answer is probably more elusive than I, or maybe even some readers would like, but I hope very much that what people find in the book is that the journey and the struggle to remember traumatic events, and again, using that word somewhat colloquially, is a worthwhile one, even if we don't necessarily find direct answers to the questions that we start out by asking.
Could you say more about that?
One of the things I realized in writing this story was I needed to have empathy for that 12-year-old girl who wasn't able to absorb everything that was happening to her and in many ways refused to absorb everything happening around her. You know, at first I found myself quite frustrated at my diary. I hadn't read my diary in decades, and I had wanted to find my emotions there, and I didn't. And eventually I moved from that frustration and disappointment in that person who was me and yet not me to have a certain kind of empathy for her. And that also brings up my sister's experiences. She was a year and a half older. We had very different experiences. I had her as a buffer. She was more on the front line as the older sibling, as any older sibling would do. She felt it was her job to keep us safe, to make sure we weren't separated, to answer the questions the commandos asked us, to talk to the press when we were released, to get us a hotel room the night we were released to Amman. And so in my story, my sister was always my hero. And yet calling her a hero, I realized, I think after I wrote the book, risked erasing her own trauma. You know, she was also a child, and it was also very important for me to have empathy for her. One of the things that occurred to me after writing the book, or I think this is in the book, but I thought about it so much afterwards, is who my sister and I became after this event. I became a scholar and a writer. Before I studied history, I studied comparative religion, world religions, and I think that was in many ways related not only to my very secular upbringing, but to the experience of the hijacking. And then as a historian, the other books I've written as a historian all in some way grapple with the lives of other people, their fears, grief, adversity in many ways. So I was indirectly thinking about the kinds of things I had been through. And then my sister, oh my goodness, my sister first became an actress. And that was in her universe. It was a way for her to be up on a stage and have a rapt audience. Because, you know, it was my sister when we came home who wanted to talk about the hijacking. And my father and I both didn't, and in many ways, shut her down. So she became an actress. And then she switched professions later in her life. She's a social worker who works with victims of domestic violence, for which I have tremendous admiration. And in many ways, what she does in that endeavor is she squarely faces the terrible things that happen within families. And in a way, I don't know for sure, who can say for sure, but it seems like both of our paths in our futures must have in some measure been affected by the hijacking and by not talking about it for so long.
Yes. And of course, being a historian also of whatever era is all about discovering not only what happened, but why.
Absolutely. And I'll just add to that, you know, I often say to my students in my history classrooms, when we're reading primary sources, we might be reading letters or journals or interviews. And I always say, or even court case testimony, why did this person tell this story this way? And that's really important because people who are becoming historians, budding historians, need to learn that what's in a document isn't transparently correct. It's somebody crafting a story. And that's the question I brought to my own diary. Why did I tell this story this way? And the answer I came to relates to what we've talked about earlier this hour. I couldn't absorb what was happening. I didn't want to remember. I wanted to protect my parents. Not that my parents would read my diary, but I wanted to have a story in that diary that wouldn't be upsetting to anybody. So I had to ask of myself, why did I tell this story this way?
And you tell this story so beautifully in this book, My Hijacking, A Personal History of Forgetting and Remembering. Martha Hodes, thank you so much. It's just been great to talk with you about this book.
Thank you, Francesca, for your wonderful questions. It's been a pleasure to be here.
Martha Hodes, read an excerpt from My Hijacking at writersvoice.net. Next up, the pandemic drives a teacher's class to go remote. The lessons he learned are coming up next. Stay tuned. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Go to writersvoice.net to find more great content, including links to our interview transcripts on our new Writer's Voice Substack. Adam Bessie, a community college English professor, found his world transformed when the pandemic exiled education from the real classroom to the digital realm. As the virtual walls closed in, Bessie witnessed the unraveling lives of his vulnerable students, a situation that hit close to home, because amid the frustrations of remote teaching, his own battle took an unexpected turn, the shadows of brain cancer resurfacing after years in remission. But in the midst of this storm, Bessie found solace in literature and in solidarity with his colleagues. Together with them, he reached out to students in crisis, rekindling his dedication to community college as a catalyst for social change and a compassionate community. In Going Remote, A Teacher's Journey, Bessie joins forces with illustrator Peter Glanting to bring us a graphic narrative about how he navigated this uncharted territory and discovered the true worth of the classroom. Bessie is a community college educator and writes comics and cartoons about a variety of educational, medical, political, and personal subjects. Adam Bessie, welcome to Writer's Voice. Going Remote, A Teacher's Journey, it's a graphic memoir about teaching, about justice, about going online with your class during the pandemic lockdown, and about you wrestling with your own cancer. It is a powerful mosaic that you put together. Tell us, what are the connections between its pieces?
Thank you so much for having me and for those lovely words. And so the best way I can do this is through alliteration. The book has numerous threads that can be distilled into the five P's. My role as a professor during the pandemic, as a parent, as a cancer patient, and, you know, most of all, a partner to my spouse, Corin, and a person. And so even though the work is called A Teacher's Journey, the goal is, as you said so well, to go beyond the sort of cardboard cutouts of how teachers are depicted and show really the multiple layers, mosaic layers that go into every single individual teacher. Well, my story is unique, as I have been living with a brain tumor for, well, since 2009. So my pandemic experience might be different for many. Anyone that's reading went through their own individual journey within the pandemic, dealing with their own health crises or other crises. And so my goal is, again, to take readers and show them those mosaic layers and those different dimensions so that we understand that my own teacher's journey is not just a journey of a teacher, but a journey of a person. And that folks that work and learn and teach in community college, we are all people. And those that live with cancer, we are all people. And this sounds sort of a little bit pedantic or simplistic, but I think over the last couple of years, there's been a really crystallizing, a hardness, a sort of cruelty where we are detached from each other's humanity. We're remote from each other's humanity. And this book, obviously, folks hopefully will get that the word remote doesn't just refer to online teaching, but the remoteness between each other. And so the goal of the book is to, yes, explore my pandemic experience as a cancer patient and a teacher and a father and all that, but also to help us think more about the ways in this particular moment that we can really strive to bridge those gaps that keep us remote.
You contrast a culture of contempt versus a culture of community. And, you know, the word is community college is right in there. You see the community college as a community of transformation. Talk about that community.
I really like that you pulled out that contrast between the sort of culture of cruelty and contempt, which comes from Zadie Smith's amazing short set of essays called Intimations. I think that's the name of it. Beautiful, written around the time of the start of the pandemic. And then the culture of community and care, that juxtaposition, that fight between those forces, I would say is the sort of primary conflict within the memoir. And most of all, within my own experience during this period. And so the community college to me is a space that, you know, really amplifies all the things that happen within the community. It's a community college. And so we've got a space in which you have a lot of people that would never be in the same space at the same time, unless they were on a public transit or something. So, for example, I often will have, you know, many students that you might think of as traditional college students, 18 years old, but really most of my students are over 18. You know, I have 50-year-old last semester, I had a 50-year-old student returning to school because her own daughter was going to school. I had a veteran who said he was more afraid of writing than anything he ever did in the Army. I have students that are from South Korea, from Finland. And so we have this exceptionally diverse community in sort of every way, shape, and form you can think of. And we've all got to be together and create community in the same space at the same time. And I think it's a really beautiful experiment in democracy on the one hand. That's how I experience it and try to create classes and contexts that do that. But embedded within the history of the community college system is eugenics. And I discussed this in the chapter focused on George Floyd's murder and my own reckoning as a white teacher and teaching students that are mostly non-white and immigrants and students of color. And in my research at the time, I found that the community college system was actually founded by active eugenicists. And this is about the turn of the 20th century. And the goal was to maintain the purity of the higher education system by having a means by which to sort of filter out people that wouldn't be appropriate for that system. So at that time, that would obviously be Black folks, immigrants, anyone that was not upper middle class white male. And that seems, you know, very ancient. And even despite all the many efforts that have happened, especially since the late 60s and 70s through present, in order to make the community college truly a space of social transformation, there's still that constant tension between the community college as a space built on care and transformation, accepting whoever comes in and trying to give them a chance in order to improve their lot and to learn, in this tension between trying to weed people out that don't fit in. My goal of this book, in part, is as somebody that is in a position of privilege. And most college professors, community college and university, are white. That is a fact. And the goal is for us all to think deeply about that history and how do we work in this battle between these opposing forces of cruelty and compassion to continue moving the arc towards compassion.
And that became much more difficult when that community went remote because of the pandemic lockdown. What did happen to that community? What happened? You talked about how community college was set up as eugenics. The very structure of community college, how did that get eroded?
Great question. Yeah, so I can just tell a story that is from the book, and I think that'll tell it best. And so I was teaching, believe it or not, a science fiction fantasy class at this time. In this opening unit of this class, we were doing a lesson on the end of the world as we know it, the literature of the apocalypse. So the opening unit was all stories that were about apocalyptic events. Now, I didn't have any foresight that this was going to occur. I just love apocalypse literature. And one of the key stories there is called The Machine Stops by E.M. Forster, which you can easily read online. E.M. Forster, who wrote, you know, Passage to India, little did you know, he also wrote this canonical science fiction story about a future, a distant future, in which all humans live underground in bunkers in their own individual cells. And the whole system is run by an AI. They don't call it that, but that's what it is. And everyone just talks to each other in their little echo chamber through like television screens. And he, believe it or not, wrote this again in 1909. And I'm teaching this. And then like within a week, we are in The Machine Stops. I'm in my garage, which we converted into what I call the teaching bunker. You know, there's like a lawnmower over here. There's cobwebs, and we set up a card table. And I have some books behind me to make it look like it's academic. We're in a class on the end of the world talking about people being in cells while each of us is in our own little cell. And this, to me, was quite literally sort of an apocalypse to this institution, the community college. Again, it's embedded within the name, community. The community now is a diaspora, and folks are flung into their houses and into their wherever they are. We have many international students, too, that would fly back to their home country. And so the community became that was a physical community in one space and one time, became this virtual community linked together by these, you know, science fiction-esque technologies, Zoom, Canvas, all of this. And the first thing that I noted, and this is discussed in the titular chapter of the book, Going Remote, is that not everybody joined us there. And in the book, you'll see this lovely image drawn by my artistic collaborator, Peter Galanting, of Cloud College. And Cloud College, as I pictured it and as depicted in the book, is literally like a cloud that on top of it has sort of a college-looking structure. And moving into it, flying into it, are these sort of Zoom cells from all the students that have been raptured to the cloud. But what you see in the corner of that page illustration is a bunch of folks on little floating islands that are reaching up because they weren't able to access Cloud College. And that was the first thing that I really observed, is when we turned the Zooms on, many students that had been there in class were not there online. And it happened to be the students that were most marginal were most unlikely to appear online. And even those students that were able to appear online, the class, such as it was, the community was mostly black boxes. As you'll see in one section, we have a whole page just of black boxes with a little mute sign. And I asked the class, is anybody here? And anyone that's been, you know, in a Zoom knows that feeling. And in fact, you know, for many students that survived or got through that first phase of getting online, getting to the end of that semester was even harder, because many of the students, even if they were able to get some kind of internet access, many of them are in multi-generational family households where they're competing for computer and internet access. And it's loud and it's, you know, and the parents may have just lost their job. And so it's an almost impossible sort of learning environment. So the system at that particular point in time, early pandemic, privileged the privileged. And this rapture that kind of brought people to the cloud, it really was easiest for those that had the best setup. And I would say that as the pandemic has moved on, that, you know, still is my concern, or is the case, that, again, to loop back to that previous sort of point about the tension between sort of cruelty and compassion, and adding to that inclusion, we're always struggling with helping the most marginalized and vulnerable in general. And to me, the pandemic has simply accelerated that difficulty and tension that happened at the start of the pandemic and to this day still persists.
You're still missing a lot of students.
Yeah, the enrollment is dramatically down in community colleges, not just in California, but across America. And on the campus itself, the campus is just much more empty than it used to be pre-pandemic. This is because of enrollment losses, but additionally, it's because many students now are opting to take fully online courses still. I would say about 50% of our English classes, at least, are still fully online. So, you know, early in the pandemic, I said, we're in Cloud College, and maybe we'll return to ground. Well, now we're kind of in like this hybrid place where everybody seems to be in both places at once. Or some of my students have never actually been on campus. The campus is not even a place that plays a role in their life. So we really have at this particular juncture entered sort of a new era or a new space where we're struggling with what is community college in an age where we're all pulled between the poles of the cloud and the ground.
This is Writer's Voice, and I'm Francesca Rhiannon. We're talking with community college teacher Adam Bessie about his graphic pandemic memoir, Going Remote. You know, you give such a wonderfully vivid account. I've been a teacher, including a teacher at a community college, and in the beginning of the book, you give a really vivid account of the kind of power. You know, you said it's powered by the students. I forget the word you use for the teacher, but the incredible electric community that is built in the classroom with students who are fully engaged and excited about what they're doing. You use that wonderful system, or inspired by it, by Paulo Freire, Pedagogy of the Oppressed. I thought of that. I had been also very, very influenced by that philosophy when I taught. Is that still possible in this new, brave new world of the tension between online and in real life?
Yes, it's definitely possible. And I want to just, for listeners that don't know Paulo Freire, yeah, he's the author of Pedagogy of the Oppressed, which is, quite frankly, a very difficult book to read. But the core idea is that how do you situate the power and the knowledge construction within the hands of students? And as someone that teaches literature and writing, that's especially important that my job is to help them develop their own ideas and concepts through group work, through conversation, through writing. And I think that in this particular world we're in now, I think everything is hybrid. I think before the pandemic, I had really intentionally avoided any kind of online teaching. And now that's not really a choice. So the question is, within this new framework, how do you create that electricity in that community, and how does the technology become part of that journey rather than replacing it? And so this last semester in my courses, which were primarily on ground, we did a lovely final project that I think embodied those two realities, where the students wrote about a community that they're a part of and very passionate about. And they had to do a lot of research and writing and narration, but then the final product needed to be a multimedia product. It could be a comic like I wrote. It could be a podcast. It could be a documentary. And at the end, they created it, they posted it online, and then we shared it with the class. And I felt that electricity again, where the tools were not the focus, but they were in service of creating that electricity and community. And the tension I see right now as we enter the age of AI, or we're deeply in the age of AI, is this piece of technology increasing this ability of learning and human connection, or is it replacing it? And I think that's sort of the fundamental tension that we're dealing with, is how do we use the tools in front of us to empower students rather than make them reliant upon them, or relate or completely replace that student interaction and student thought with a technology.
Yeah, and you ask, are students people or data points? And you point out that this was a process that was already beginning before the pandemic, but of course has accelerated since it. So I want to ask you first to talk a little bit about, you know, as you say, the free market technocrats who are seeing this as an opportunity to accelerate their agenda to monetize public education. That's on the one hand. And on the other hand, what would a remote classroom designed around the students as people look like? So, I mean, that's a big lot to bite off, but start with the first.
I've been chewing on it for a long time. So, for example, in 2013, I wrote a comic called Automated Teaching Machine about teachers being replaced by robots. So I've been thinking about this for a long time. And this has roots in No Child Left Behind, was really and that's where I got my start first as a high school teacher and then later college, is the sort of the standardized testing revolution, I think, created this sort of framework that we still exist in, which reduces learning to data sets and considers success to be related to the production of the completion of tests and the production of standardized knowledge, this sort of factory model type thinking. And so something that I've written about earlier that's alluded to this in this book, when you look in the third chapter and there's a picture of an assembly line, a lot of the educational system is built on this sort of mechanized assembly line thinking. And this is before we have tools such as, you know, ChatGPT and others that could just automate that process. So again, these ideologies and trends, which serve to treat students as objects or products and not people, have been there well before this current tension, this current moment. And it'll be long after as well. And it just sort of reframes the question, as I asked sort of at the end, sort of like the technology, it's in a way we're not dealing with anything new. It's the tension between the banking model, which Freire talks about, this idea of you just throw knowledge into a student's mind and then they spit it out, and the tension between having a class built on curiosity and discussion that maybe is more inefficient but more effective. And the technology just reframes that question, but we have to think about, well, if we're going to be in a technological space, how do we use it to create a knowledge transforming discussion, human-centered classroom, as opposed to having one that is more automated? So to me, again, while it seems like we're in a completely new world, the remote world, classrooms, many of them were quite remote, even in person. And just think about classes you've had where the teacher's in the front of the room droning and everyone else is just taking notes. Now, that's a face-to-face class, but that is a remote class. And I have had remote teaching classes, literally remote, that were more intimate than lecture classes like that. So I think when we think about what going remote is trying to get at is whatever context we find ourselves in, how do we leverage and use the tools around us and advocate for the tools to create a human and student-centered class that really includes as many folks as possible with the knowledge that there will be like no utopia. Like this challenge between these forces is going to have to be fought by every new generation of educators.
And it's very much, of course, a fight over justice, over access, over empowerment. Those are our words too. How do we empower people? And one of the, you know, really struck me, you have a chapter where you talk about, well, it starts out with a student who shares with you that she was thinking of suicide. And You say that you filed more suicide prevention reports in 1 month after you went remote with your class than you had done in all the previous year. And this is just really emphasizes the kind of anomie, the kind of alienation that people feel when they lose that community that you had. So talk about what happened there and also how you got involved in suicide prevention efforts on campus.
And just one little correction, this team, suicide prevention is part of it, but it's about this team called the CARE team. We have students with domestic violence, with homelessness, many, many other issues. So this was just in the book, a particularly harrowing account, which you'll see I'm running in the morning, which I did every day during the pandemic in the darkness. And I'm just thinking about this email I received, which basically said, I didn't get my homework done. And I'm like, okay, let's see what this is. That was a common email. And the person said, well, I couldn't get my homework done because I attempted suicide. And I'm like, what? And during this span of time, I just every week would get, that was a very acute email, but I would get numerous mental health emails, illness emails, all kinds of things that I'm not equipped for. And there's a phrase in the book that I think really captures a lot of where I was then and where I think a lot of teachers are now. I felt more like a social worker than a teacher. Like, I'm not trained to be a social worker. I don't have that background, those skills, that knowledge. And yet, during the pandemic, while I was remote from my students, I was like a frontline worker for these emotional issues without any training. So I filed so many of these reports. They said the team, which is comprised of counselors, social workers, a psychiatrist, police services, administrators, you know, they said, you know, Adam, why don't you just join our team as the faculty rep? And so I have now been doing that. And that's been now 3 years. I've been on that team with weekly meetings where whenever a staff member, you know, observes a student in crisis, and that crisis, again, could be domestic issues, financial, homelessness, anxiety, depression, you name it, the team attempts to connect those person to services. And this particular moment represented in the book is very acute, but I've seen this since that time, that drumbeat of struggles with mental health proceed apace. I have not really seen it abate. And the American Psychological Association came out with a report recently about the youth crisis in mental health. And indeed, teachers, all of us are seeing that, which was actually in the making well before the pandemic, but obviously the pandemic made it much worse. And again, teachers, none of us have any training in how to deal with any of this kind of work. And also many teachers themselves are having a mental health crisis because we're dealing with our own challenges. And with the vicarious trauma of being hit with numerous student challenges. And so when we talk about a culture of cruelty as opposed to a culture of compassion and care, a unit like the care team is critical, where the school is not just a place that feeds knowledge into people's heads, but it's a community that takes care of each other. And if we're really going to make the community college that kind of space, we're going to really need to have wellness, not just for students, but for staff and teachers at top of mind. And I don't at this moment see that we've made any transformations to address that youth mental health crisis, nor I think the crisis that many teachers are experiencing with their own mental health and with burnout and other things. So I think that, again, the tension is here between, like, are we going to take care of people or are we going to just let them sort of struggle and suffer? And I'm hoping this book inspires more community colleges and teachers to look at the broader mission of teaching as not just depositing content or giving degrees, but to create a space of really connection for the teachers and for the students on their learning journey.
And the book does it so well, not only because of the content, but one really gets a sense of the incredible synergy that is made up of that kind of understanding of compassion between you and the illustrator, Peter Glanting. So I wonder, you know, just as a final question, if you could talk a little bit about that synergy between the two of you, because it just is really infused with that spirit of the book.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, I was hoping we could talk a little bit about the artistic process as well. And this is an unusual book in the sense that it's a memoir, but Peter, my exceptionally talented illustrator, collaborated with me on it. So it's like a collaborative memoir, which is, you know, kind of a strange pursuit. And there's not too many examples of that within comics or other fields. And so Pete and I had this really, I think this show is called The Writer's Voice. This might be interesting to the listeners, the kind of process we undertook. I thought about it kind of like a band, like we were a two-person band and each of us had sort of our skill sets or our roles within that band. And we knew what the other person's role was as well. So we can make a harmonic final product, which I think going remote is, where it feels like a singular vision. And so the way this would work is that I, you know, did the experiencing, obviously went through it, and then would write the script for it. And thankfully, Pete is not only a fantastic artist, but he also was an English major. And so Pete and I would then have a Zoom meeting. I know this is very ironic given the content of the book. He lives in Portland. I'm in the San Francisco Bay Area. And so after I would like finish a draft I felt good about, which often was way too long, I would share it with Pete and we'd go page by page through that work. And I would write all of the dialogue and the captions, but I also would have some sort of proposals for what I thought cool images would be. But I knew that that was really Pete's terrain, that Pete is a fantastically talented artist. So I wanted to make sure that even though this is my memoir, that he felt a sense of ownership and voice within this work, that this was his work too. So we would have that Zoom meeting and talk about everything and brainstorm live images. So for example, when you see that image of Cloud College in the book, I was obsessed with that idea because I liked the alliteration of Cloud College and all that. And then I said, well, Pete, what do you think about this? And so on the Zoom, he just doodled something. And I'm like, oh, that looks great. Go for it. And so we would come up with images to work on. And then Pete often would help me to edit at least 5 to 6 pages down because, you know, I'm a writer. I want to overwrite it. And then I would go back and rewrite the script based on his notes. He'd start on the illustrations. And then we would meet again and refine and refine until we got to that sort of final product. And it was just such a remarkable and therapeutic experience, I think, for both of us, that in the heart of the pandemic, when we, you know, our social lives are so constricted, that we could sit together and tell stories to each other and talk and do art and transform the trauma into a story. So it was a really beautiful process. And I continue to work with Pete on other work. So it was really transformative. And, you know, as I say in the notes of the book, it really was a work of graphic medicine for myself. And my hope is for some readers, especially teachers and folks with cancer and other folks, will read the book and will feel a sense of some of their own experience that they may not have seen reflected.
Mm. It's such a powerful book. And as you say, and the illustrations just are so fitting. The book is Going Remote, A Teacher's Journey. Adam Bessy, it's just been great to talk with you about this book.
Thank you so very much. I really enjoyed the conversation.
Adam Bessy, Going Remote was picked by Publishers Weekly as one of 2023's top 10 graphic novels. Go to writersvoice.net to hear more of our conversation, where Bessy talks about the synergy he experienced with his illustrator, Peter Glanting. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.